Thanks, Jim. I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Good to be here. This is Zelda. She's going to probably be pretty good. She's the soberest dog in AA. Mostly she sits quietly at the meetings, but if she starts to talk a little bit, I'm going to kick her out. But thanks for that. I appreciate that. Great introduction. Really, we're all just afraid of Dan, is what it is. We're afraid not to do what Dan wants us to do. Dan's one of the best guys ever, so I appreciate anytime Dan asks me to do anything, I'm going to happily do it. We just had a little AA event. I moved to Berkeley Springs, West Virginia. My story, I'll tell you more about that, but I just moved to Berkeley Springs, West Virginia about 4 months ago. And before that, I'd been out at Tacoma, Washington. I capped my work career. It was a great opportunity out there. And my wife and I were out there. We were East Coasters, but we went out there for 2 years. And we got here on Berkeley Springs in July. I have a grandson and a granddaughter here, and we decided that this is where we're gonna. I retired, and we decided this is where we're gonna hang our hat for a while, and hopefully for a long time. But so we're here, and Dan and a couple of guys from Leesburg all took a ride about an hour and a half to check out that our meetings here in Berkeley Springs met requirements. So it was great to see those guys, and that's just a great AA, kind of event. We get together. Those guys got to ride in a car for an hour and a half, having a meeting over. We had a great time. We had a bunch of heart bad food, had a little diner in West Virginia, and then they headed back. But it's great to see everybody. Let me just start with my sobriety date, September 2nd, 1986. And I got sober. I didn't intend, I like to say, I wasn't really intending to do that necessarily. The day before my sobriety date, what's important about the day before I got sober was that I wasn't going to drink that day. The day before my sobriety date, when I woke up that morning, I wasn't going to drink. And I'd been going through a few, months of that. I was trying not to drink, and somehow I got struck drunk, and it was a whole big event, and it was I blacked out, I passed out, and I came to. That was that drunk, and it was not a remarkable drunk, but it was just one of many. And particularly that particular morning, I woke up and I just said I couldn't do it anymore. Right, that was it. As a kid, I have both my parents are alcoholics. I come from a good Irish Catholic family. My dad and my mom are both alcoholics. I can say that because they did. They both got sober in AA. My mom passed away about 12 years ago. She had 44 years of sobriety. My dad passed away in 1989. He had about 10 years of sobriety. They both got sober. They loved AA. They were just great members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew you people because you came to my house. We used to have little meetings on my front porch, and I liked you guys very much, and I liked what you guys had did for my parents. So I had no real qualms about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was a pretty cool organization. But as a kid growing up, I had two parents that were both drunks. And so there's a lot of crazy, weird stuff happened in my house, and it didn't quite make any sense. I would find bottles of wine in the hamper. It was my mom's. And I'd show up and hand them to her, and say, "How did this get here? That's crazy." And my mom would laugh. "Oh, yeah, must have misplaced it again." And then I did it one time in front of my dad when she was there, and she got freaked out. But that was the kind of stuff that used to show up. She had bottles hidden around the house. And then she got sober when I was 11. And I remember at the time, as a kid, I was scared all the time. I was scared a lot. We moved around a lot as a kid, and I was always the new kid in school and all that, and I felt anxious a lot. But I remember when my mom went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that's what was going on. I just knew my mom was leaving the house, going to meetings. And the self-centered little kid I was at 11, I thought she was going because I was in trouble at school, because she was going to churches and schools, and she was going every night. And I just figured, oh my God, I'm in trouble. And whatever the reason, I wasn't getting yelled at, so I was just being quiet about it, so I didn't say a word. But for months, I thought that she was going because I was in trouble at school. Turns out that's not what was going on. And my dad stopped drinking when my mom went into AA, and there was a whole big thing. Little thing occurred when I was, I guess I was 11, 11 or I would have been 11, right? My dad stopped drinking. My mom stopped drinking. There was no booze in my house, and they were drinking. My mom was drinking club soda. My dad was drinking half and half, the grapefruit soda. And there was like three beers left in the refrigerator. They had been there since everybody stopped drinking. And the little 11-year-old Mike went out and I grabbed a beer. I wanted to try it. And it wasn't the first time I've snuck drinks before, but little 11-year-old Mike grabbed a beer and I drank it. And that night my dad came home and freaked out. He started screaming at my mom about how he's sitting there not drinking for her, and there she is, drinking his beer. And she said, "I didn't drink the beer. I don't know what happened to it." So my dad started drinking that night. And I always felt guilty about that. I always felt like it was my fault that my dad started drinking again. I hadn't thought about that for like years. Of course, in the course of, I did some work with that. My dad had passed away by the time I really did any work on it, but I talked to my mom about it. And in the course of our amends, I talked about that. But that was a real historical event. As a little 11-year-old, 12-year-old kid, my dad's drinking like a shithead again, and it's my fault, And as I started drinking around 12, 13, I guess 7th, 8th grade, I started drinking with my friends. I remember the first time I went out like that was I picked up a six-pack of Schlitz, right? And we went down to the park, drank the beer. I guess I was camping out in somebody's backyard. That's what it was. And I drank the beer, and I threw up, and I kind of blacked out. But somewhere between drinking the beer and throwing up, something really magical occurred. It was the greatest thing. I felt that anxiety relieved. I felt confident. All the stuff that that little 12, 13-year-old kids feel, I was that got pushed aside, and I found that this was the key. This was the thing. I always felt like there was something I didn't know, and that you guys all knew it, and you knew I didn't know it, but you weren't going to tell me what it was. And when I drank that time, I went, "Oh my God, this is the kick. This is it." And drank. Trying to chase that quite a bit. I went and I was a weekend warrior in high school. I was, that type of kid. By the time I was a freshman, I was drinking about every weekend without the friends, and I hang out with the guys who did that. I was usually a little bit older kids than me. By the time I was a sophomore, junior, I was pretty adept at getting booze, getting beer, and so I had fake IDs, things like that. And though I didn't look at all old enough, I mean, at that time, the drinking age where I lived was 18. So you could kind of fake it there. I mean, I was pretty good at getting beer on weekends, sometimes during the week, but mostly it was weekends, smoking weed and stuff that I grew up and came of age in the 70s. So I was doing a lot of stuff that all the kids were doing that I was doing. And things would start happening. I was already having blackouts. By the time I was a teenager, I was having blackouts. And really for a blackout at that time for me was simply the, it was, you guys were going to tell me what I did because I couldn't remember it. And other times I told them what they did because they didn't remember it. So those were the kind of kids I was drinking with. I fit right in with this. They know that the guys, we had blackouts. We drank way too much. And I was a bad student. All that stuff. I really didn't care about anything. I was a very apathetic student. I was apathetic about most things, but I liked to drink. I did play some sports. And I would go periods of time where I wouldn't smoke and drink if I was kind of being watched. But for the most part, I drank and I smoked cigarettes and all that stuff all the way through that time. And it was always kind of a rebellious thing. So that was kind of me being in high school. I'll tell a story. When I was a senior, I went to a Catholic high school. And by the way, I got nothing bad to say about Catholic schools. They were great to me. The nuns were wonderful. I have nothing bad to say about them. And they were very kind to me, as a matter of fact. But every year I would be in trouble in high school, around halfway through the demerit. We had a demerit system, and I was always at the point where I had to have a meeting with my parents in January or so. And we had an annual meeting in January. And in my senior year, they told my mom that I wasn't going to class, and I would miss a lot of classes, particularly first, second period. And they said that if I didn't pass all my classes and attend all my classes from now till the end of the year, I wouldn't graduate with my class. And I was gonna have to stay in summer school to get my diploma. I had a sister who was a great student. She was in college at the time, and she was the opposite of me. She didn't drink, she didn't smoke, and she did really well in school. So she made a deal with me. She said that if I graduated with my class, now I didn't have to have a certain average, I didn't have to be honors, I just had to graduate on time. And if I did that, she would provide for me upon my graduation a half keg. So that was the greatest semester of my life. I did great. I was at class. I participated. I got great grades. And I swear to this day that if someone had made that deal to me in ninth grade, I'd have gone to Harvard, because I had that was the finally had the incentive for something to be participate and do well. But I didn't have that. So I graduated on time, got off, and then that summer I decided I was going to join the Navy. All my friends were, there were, college wasn't something I really wanted to do. I wasn't a good student, wasn't interested in doing that. So I decided to join the Navy. I joined the Navy in September of that year after I graduated, and that whole summer was summer of Mike. Drunk. I was drunk every night, drunk all the time. All my friends were suckers. They had to go to work, pay for school and all that stuff, and I was just having a great time. Went to the Navy and ran right into the guys that drank the way I did right away. They were like waiting for me on the ship, and they had a beer in their hand. Let's go, and I gravitated to those kind of guys, and I like, I've heard people say they learn how to drink in the Navy. I knew how to drink, but I really, at that point now, I had no more. There's nothing holding me back, because I had some money. I had, I was off every night when we were in port. And I just what I could just drink. I was with all the guys that were my age, and we drank, and that was pretty much my 4 years in the Navy. As I traveled, I was on an aircraft carrier, had a cool job. I liked what I did. I was an air intercept controller. I used to run F-14s into each other, but hopefully not hit each other. But it was just a cool job for a 19, 20-year-old kid, and I got around the world. I got to Europe, but I can tell you, I got no pictures of it. I saw the insides of bars and the outsides of churches. That's what I remember about going around there. I would rarely get more than a few blocks away from where the ship ported, where the Liberty Launch would drop you off. I'd get into the bars and pretty much stay there. Sometimes I get off. I shouldn't say never, because I never say never about most stuff. But quite often, the first couple bars I found, that's where I stayed for a couple of days. And that was the typical of my travel in the Navy. I found the guys that drank the way I did, and we drank, and that's what we did. And I spent 4 years in, got in. I was smoking weed at the time, and this was around the time that it wasn't as big a deal when I first got in, and it got to be a big deal when I was getting out. And I went through a whole big process. Now, I loved the work I did in the Navy, and I liked the guys. It was interesting. I liked to travel, and it came down to time: was I going to stay in or get out? I could, and I knew pretty much if I stayed in the Navy for one tour, hung up, if I shipped over, I was going to be in for 20. So I had this big long list of things. On the left, why I would do it; on the right, why I wouldn't do it. And it came right, and I had all these different things. But the reality was, I knew that I couldn't pass the drug test; that they were going to eventually get me. And the job I had, I would lose my security clearance. And then, so if I flunked a drug test, I'd lose my security clearance. I would lose my job, and I'd be kicked out. So I said, I left. I left the Navy. Basically, that's why I left. I went back to Pittsfield, Massachusetts. It's in the Berkshire Mountains of Western Massachusetts. It's an idyllic place. I often say I grew up in the mean streets of Pittsfield, and that's a joke. I mean, it was a Norman Rockwell kind of existence. The people there were beautiful, nice to me. Everybody's mom stayed at home. It was like everybody's dad worked for General Electric in the plant, except mine. I grew up in the neighborhood. Everybody's mom could, they, if I got in trouble with Frank Popolski's mom, I was going to hear about it when I got home from my mom. That was the kind of place it was. It was a great place to grow up. So I went back there, and I was full of confidence. I was 22 years old. I'd seen the world. All those rubes around, they didn't know shit. And I was going to be, I was the best. I was going to go to school. I was going to go off to take on the world. And what I basically did is I got drunk, and I stayed drunk for a lot of that period. I went to school at a community college. And I say I went to school, but I didn't go to class. I would get to school in the morning at 9 o'clock and smoke a joint and blow off the class, smoke another joint at 10 o'clock. And then by noon, we have to go out and have beers because it was lunchtime, and that was what was going on. That's the way I went to school. And I didn't attend classes, and I was on the GI Bill. What I would do is I would find out when the withdrawal date, because I found out if I withdrew and didn't flunk, it was better for me as far as my GI Bill. Somehow, I don't know why it was necessarily better, but it seemed to be better. So I would find out when I signed up for my classes when the last day was I could withdraw without getting an F, and I would just write that down in my head, and I would withdraw before I can catch an F. And so that was I did that. I went to school for about 3 years. After years later, when I different things, I went back to get my grades, because something came up. I was looking into my grades, and it was real interesting. Mostly I got W's, all withdrawals. But one semester, I saw that I decided I was going to take five classes because that was the time I was going to really buckle down and do well. I got four F's and a B, because what had happened was, when it came time to withdraw, I was drunk and I overslept and I didn't make it to get the withdrawal. So I flunked all those classes, and then I got a B, and the class I got a B in was called effective thinking. So I got a B in effective thinking, and I flunked everything else. The effective thinking class was taught by a guy who was a drunk, and I took that class because I knew that the mornings you'd show up and he'd have a little sign saying, "No class today. See you tomorrow. See you on Wednesday," because he was drunk and hungover. He was a good dude. I liked him. So, anyways, that was he taught effective thinking. That was typical of my kind of school. That was what I was doing. I wasn't doing well, so I went into drunk all the time. And I say drunk all the time. I would drink because I was getting money on the GI Bill. I did some odd jobs. I did part-time work. Then I decided to go to work full-time. That was when I really started drinking heavy, heavier. I was drinking every day, pretty much. I was a bar drinker. I went to the bars. I would drink on the way to the bar. I would, on the way to drinking, I would drink. I'd have anxiety, and this anxiety seemed to go away when I drank. I would feel. I went to a bar. I had drank in this bar. It's no longer there, but it was called the Home Plate Cafe. It was the kind of bar you stopped for a quick beer on the way to robbing a bank, right? It was that kind of place. And 90% of the people in there, I couldn't stand. I hated them, and they didn't like me. 90% didn't like me, but I kept going back every night because that was my bar. And I think about that, and that's crazy. I hated that place and kept going back because it was my bar, and there was no way I was gonna be kicked out of my bar. And that's where I would drink, start the nights. I was drinking, and when I say drink, sometimes, especially when I was working, there was days I didn't make it to work because I was out on a drunk for a couple of days. And for me, I found that it's in we agnostics. If you've had a hard time, if you really try to drink and you find yourself you can't do it, or once you start you have a difficult time stopping, then you might have a problem. Well, that was with me. Sometimes I went out for 10, 12 beers. Sometimes I was out for 2 or 3 days. And I didn't know what was going to happen once it started. Once I began to drink, that's when we would find out what was going to happen. And not to say that every time was 2 or 3 days, it wasn't. But there was times that I had no intention of doing that, and that's what happened. I stayed out drunk for a couple of days and missed work, miss events, miss things. I was living away from my parents' house at the time, and I kept having to move back because I'd run out of money, because I was spending all my money on drinking and drugs and gambling. I did all that too. That came went all hand in hand with my drinking. And I'm not going to make my drunk log last much longer than this, because I got a couple DUIs, DWIs, at those they were called in those days. The first time I got one was it was 4 o'clock in the morning. I was on my way to pick up a bottle of cranberry juice or orange juice, or of cranberry and orange juice, because I had a bottle of vodka, and I knew that if I drank the vodka straight, I was an alcoholic. So I went out in the middle of the night and ran to a traffic light in a snowstorm, and the cops arrested me, and I got arrested for drunk driving that night. That was my first DUI. Second DUI, I was on my way home from a bar, and the cop pulled me over. I was up in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And I often say the guy in the song Alice's Restaurant, Arlo talks about Officer Obie, who's the one who arrested him. Well, I got arrested by the guy that took over for Officer Obie. He arrested me, and I got arrested for drunk driving again. And I lost my license for 2 years. I went through the whole big deal. At that time, MAD was really becoming a big deal in Massachusetts, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And I remember that the day I came home from being bailed, getting out of jail, there was a big headline in the local paper. It says, "Massachusetts to crack down on drunk drivers." It was a headline in the paper. And there I was, busted, drunk driving again. And I'd lost my last job. The last job I had, let's see, around this time, well, this period of time was October of 85. So that's when I got arrested. I was working at a job. I had a job where I didn't have to do anything, and I couldn't do it. I got fired from it eventually because I didn't have, I had no challenge, no responsibilities, no, nothing to do. All I do is be there, and I didn't do it. And so they fired me for being a drunk. Around that time, I didn't have a car. I couldn't, I was walking everywhere I went. I remember around this period of time, walking home from the bar at 2 o'clock in the morning and thinking to myself, well, the problem here is that you keep driving. You know, if you just stop, if I just don't drive, I'll be fine. And really, I don't need to drive because I don't have a job. The bars I like are where I can walk, and I can stumble home from them. They're close enough I can get to them. Liquor stores all around. And it made sense to me. That was the kind of reasoning thinking I had at that time. I don't need to drive, and I'll just stay out of trouble that way. I think about, you know, I had no money. I somehow I got drunk. I would go out of my house with $5 and end up drunk as shit. And I don't know how I did that. Either I was stealing money, or I was just being, you know, being my friends were taking care of me, that kind of stuff. I was just a freeloader, and I did that for months, oh, years, a couple of years, I guess. And that was typical. That was the kind of person I was. I didn't care about it. I didn't care what I had to do to get drunk. I would just do it. Steal, borrow, beg, whatever. Always, and my money, whatever money I had at the time, whatever money I earned, I always spent it all, and I owed. I had tabs in liquor stores, bars all over town, and I would just kind of give money to them to keep it going. But I was always broke. Always. I spent all my money on alcohol and drugs, everything I had, and plus I always owed. And it went on. It was in this time. This period was. It was about 2 years, I guess. You know, and it was. And I think about people talk about their bottom. My bottom was around this time. You know, there wasn't a one single event necessarily. It was like Groundhog Day. It was just every day was the same. It was come to do the thing. I got this buddy of mine. His name was Grub. We called him Grub, and he was pretty much the same situation I was in. And I, you know, I'd come to about 10, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'd meet Grub down at the end of the street. There's a river, Housatonic River, would go by, and we'd go down there. And we'd smoke a joint, start the day off right. And so I'm 27, 28 years old. And Grubb says to me one morning, he says, "Hey, you know, all our friends are gone. They've gone off to New York or Boston, and they're making themselves. You know, they went to school and got jobs." He says, "We're the last two left. We're the survivors." And I just thought, "Oh my God, a survive? We're surviving. We're not surviving. I don't want to survive. I want to do better than that." But those are the little memories around that period of time I had. So I bring it back to that day, September 2nd, 1986. Came to that morning. It was just, and the drunk was just typical. It was. I started out not going to drink. I wasn't going to drink. I had no intention of drinking, and I'd been going to meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous for probably since around May or June of that year. I had some friends that were taking me to meetings, and I was smoking weed, reading the Big Book, and for some reason it wasn't working for me. I couldn't figure it out, and I would just, you know, I wasn't drinking every time, but it was the bizarrest things were happening. When I drank, particularly that period of time, it would just be these crazy drunks. You know, I would just because I guess I was getting enough AA in my head to mess me up, you know, and I was hiding it. I was pretending I wasn't. There was one time I went to a wrestling match, professional wrestling match, which is not something I normally did. I ended up walking around the ring with a big thing of beer, and it was on TV on Saturday because they were filming it the day we were there. And I was on TV wandering around a wrestling ring, like, because I found out that if you walked around and if you stood still, they'd say, "Hey, you got to go find your seat." But if I kept walking around the ring, they let me do it. So I had this beer in my hand, and I'm on TV all day long, walking around the ring. I'm terrified that people in AA are going to see that I did that, you know, that they're going to see, like they were watching wrestling and seeing me there. But that was the kind of stuff, it was nuts. And stuff like that was happening over and over. I went to, at that particular time, yeah, I had t no intention of here or there. That's right. I had no intention of drinking that day. That was another time I wasn't going to drink. I left the house with these guys. And they all, you know, they all bought beer for the ride. So I bought 2 6-packs of orange soda to ride from Pittsfield to Hartford, which was an hour and 15-minute ride. I bought 2 6-packs of orange soda because, you know, if I was going to drink beer, I would have grabbed a couple 6-packs of beer. So I figured I'm going to do the same thing. And then I got as far as the Massachusetts Turnpike, and I started cracking beers, and that was that. And the next day, the guy who drove us, he was cleaning out his cooler, and he came back. He said he had 11 orange sodas. So I drank one, and that was it. The rest of the time I was drinking, and that was just madness. So came to that morning. I had no job. I was done. I was just so beat up, and I was so sick of being drunk. I was so sick of being a loser. I was so sick of every negative feeling in my stomach was there. So I didn't know what to do. I just said, I just can't do this anymore. That was it. I can't do this anymore. And so what I learned was that particular morning is when I took both parts of the first step. I didn't know that. And so for the very first time, I took both parts of the first step. Powerless. I knew I was powerless because I would go out drinking, and sometimes it would take months. I mean, sometimes it would take days, and sometimes it would be out for 12 drinks. But my life as a manageable part was what I kept fighting off. You know, I wasn't unmanageable because I kept making it, I kept settling for less. That's what a guy in Lenox, Mass taught me, that what we do as alcoholics, we keep settling for less. And that, so I kept pushing that off, you know. And I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to have a relationship with another person. I didn't want to finish school. I didn't want to have a good job. I'd rather drink. And I kept doing that and doing that. And my life kept, I kept trying to make it manageable. And so that morning, I was just not going to do that, you know. And the second step, you know, powerless over, you know, I came to believe that power greater than myself could restore me to sanity was, you know, and I came to understand that that was, we're talking the sanity of the first drink, the insanity of picking up that first drink. You know, and that's what the second step is all about. And when I look at that, I realize all the things that booze can do to me and has done to me over the years, and pick it up anyways. And that I did over and over, you know, in that. And so I believe I got to take the first and the second step every single day. I've heard it said, you know, you only got to take the first step every day, or that's the depth step you have to take. I believe I have to take the second step also, because I have to realize the madness of what I pick up a drink or a drug does to me. For me to pick it up is complete insanity. And my life got better. You know, I wasn't going to do a drunk log here, so here I am. Whenever someone says they're not going to do a drunk log, strap in, right? But let me talk about my recovery part. To me, that's the cool part of my story. I got sober in Pittsfield, Mass. I had a great sponsor who led me through the steps. He really focused strong, and this is what we did, him and I. We focused on the first three steps the first year. We did fourth and fifth step after a year, but you know, by the time I did a fifth step with him, it wasn't anything he didn't know already. We'd already talked about all that stuff. And I don't advocate that one way or the other. That's what happened when I did it. And I got through this, and I got through in the first year. I got through the I can say it took me 18 months to get through the first 12 steps of the program for the first time I did it. But really, you know, it was continuously ongoing with my sponsor. We were working them, you know, and that I got sent off after I was sober a while. I went to Oklahoma City. I got offered an opportunity to go work for the government, and I got put in an academy out there, FAA Academy. And right away, I got joined up with AA as soon as I could, and with some great AA out there, you know, some great people out there. And I tell a story. I was at a meeting, you know, and I was sober about 18 months ago or so, I guess, just a year to somewhere in there, and just absolutely terrified and nervous, didn't know what was happening. And people wouldn't call me. I'd raise my hand and they wouldn't call me, right? And what's wrong with these people? They don't call me. And just feeling lonely and scared. And so I finally got called on by somebody, and I just lashed out on them. I said, "You people suck. This is terrible AA. You don't know anything about it. You know, this is a Bible Belt hypocrites. And you're a bunch of idiots. If you want to know about being sober, you should go back to Massachusetts. They'll tell you about how to get sober." And all this Oki said was, "Well, Mike, we kind of like our AA around here. We hope you'll keep coming back. Maybe you'll like it too." That's all he said to me. And it just kind of dropped it. And after the meeting, the guys all came up to me, and I had a bunch of phone numbers. And I was able to realize what was happening here wasn't anything wrong with Oklahoma City AA. It was me. And that's the only way I could do it at the time. After I went to Oklahoma City, I got a job in Connecticut, and I remember sitting in a meeting in Connecticut thinking, "You people don't know nothing about AA around here. You should go back to Oklahoma City. That's where AA is, right?" You know, and I didn't say it this time because I was smart enough to know this was me, it wasn't them. And got in really in. I just immersed myself in AA whenever I go anywhere, any place I go. Connecticut, I did it again. I did that as well. And let's see, you know, I can. give you the high points of there my sobriety. I worked for the government, had a great job, loved what I did. I got married, had a great AA program. I was sponsoring guys, had a sponsor, you know, just and just my life was so awesome. You know, as I had the anxiety was going away. I learned about meditation and prayer, you know, and I had relationships with people, and I wasn't and it wasn't perfect. I mean, I stumbled and struggled, did all the stuff, you know. I went through being single in AA. Oh my God, that's brutal. The talk about how you can replace a drink with women. It's crazy how in the nuttiness of that, you know. I remember once I was supposed to, so this girl I was supposed to visit on Cape Cod, she was living with a different guy at the time, by the way, and I was going to meet her, and the big hurricane, Hurricane Bob, came and wiped out Cape Cod, and I remember at the time I couldn't reach her, and I was supposed to be there on the weekend, and I couldn't reach her because all the phone lines were down and power was out, and I remember sharing with this guy, one of the old timers in AA, saying, "God, I guess God doesn't want me to see this girl this weekend," and he just looks at me and says, "Yeah, that's how my God works. He takes a hurricane and wipes out power for 100,000 people and makes them homeless just so you can have a date on Saturday night. Yeah, that's how my God works." And he turned around and walked away. I got to realize, I guess I'm kind of more self-centered than I want to realize. But those are the kind of people I got immersed with and meshed with and did a lot of. I went to the convention in 1990 in Seattle. That was awesome. And just my life was just really wonderful. I had a great time. I was married. Then things went different. You know, the job went south. I was no longer, I was going to be able to retire in like 2 years, and I ended up losing that job. And not based on anything I had done, just reality is what happened. And me and 2,000 others, we lost our positions, and we were went. And I still had a job, but I wasn't working for the government anymore. I lost all of my benefits, and I was angry and furious and blah 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 and. And went to Congress. Me and a bunch of guys went to Congress trying to stop it, and we couldn't do it. The next thing I knew, my reality was different, and I was angry, I didn't, I didn't, you know, it wasn't fair, blah blah blah. And I spent 2 years back, still in Connecticut, and then I got hired back by the government, and I ended up commuting back and forth between Connecticut and D.C. And what happened was, I realized it was difficult. It was hard. But professionally, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I got to do things I didn't even know existed, and I got to and I achieved. I did well. I came up in the ranks. I did this for like 11 years. Drove back and forth between Connecticut and D.C. Living in Northern Virginia, I went to meetings, and I got a message in meetings right away. You know, so I was going to meetings in Connecticut. I was going to meetings in Virginia, and I would hear stuff in Virginia and repeat it back in Connecticut and do the Connecticut and Virginia. It's that way I could still look smart at both places. I would steal from everybody, and you know it was a real interesting experience. I ended up getting divorced. It was too much for. I think that the commuting was too much. Plus, there was other things wrong with the marriage. So I ended up getting divorced, and I started. You know, I stayed in Virginia. I was doing meetings here, and I got real involved with stuff here. Club 12. I got involved in that. I've been on the board of directors there, and I. As my life went along, I got married again. I got married to somebody in AA, a wonderful lady. She's awesome. We have a great life together now. And we just, you know, we prioritize sobriety. We just do. It's the most important thing in our lives. And I'll speak for myself, most important thing in my life, you know, and that every opportunity that I can't, everywhere I've lived, the first thing I do is I get involved in AA. I just try and find the best place I can. You know, I look around, see where I fit in. I don't fit in everywhere. And you have to go to a bunch of meetings. But once I find the place I fit in, I just stay there. You know, that's where I go and meet the people there. I try to get involved. I try and do what I can. I've been around a while now, so I try not to. I moved to Berkeley Springs recently, as I said, and I sat there in the meetings thinking about all the shit they're doing wrong. And I said, "Shut up, Mike. Shut up. Stay here. You know, grow where you're planted, right? Just grow where you're planted. There's great AA here. It's great people." As I said, we traveled, we went, and stuff I got to do in the last few years. I was given an opportunity to travel out to Tacoma, and my wife Susan and I and our dog Zelda, We were on a Prius and we put a tent on the top of our car and we drove cross country between Virginia to Washington and we camped. We camped. We went, we stopped in Denver to see her son, and then we went through Yellowstone and just the national parks. And we camped our way through, and it was a phenomenal experience. And I got out to the Pacific Northwest and got to meet people out there. And again, I got involved in AA right away as quickly as I could. And there's great meetings out there. The people there were phenomenal. Just and it's a whole different vibe, West Coast to East Coast. It really is. And I got to like it. I liked being out there. There were nice people. Chinese food wasn't so hot, and the pizza stunk. But other than that, I liked it. And the people there were wonderful. We spent 2 great years out there, and I got to do something professionally that I didn't even know this job existed. And I got to be, it was so cool. And interestingly enough, it was I worked in a place where they do intercepts, western part of the United States. So, for instance, when an airplane is gonna get intercepted by something, if something comes up, and not to get too into the weeds on it, a fighter, they're gonna put a fighter on something because there's, something's going on that they're worried about, and they're gonna keep an eye on it. It gets controlled out of where I was in Tacoma, and interestingly, that's where I started in the Navy. I was an intercept controller, so somehow I went full circle around and got to do that. Started that way and ended that way. And there was like, there's no road to do that. It just the way it went. I just kept showing up, going to the meetings, doing my job best I can, and somehow God got me to do that. That's how my life has worked. Honest to God, I mean, it's not. I like to say, oh, Mike was a really impressive guy. No, he wasn't. I just simply showed up, did my job the best I could, and said yes a lot, and ended up getting to do. I've gotten to do. I got to sit in the back seat of a fighter plane. And take a flight out like that. I mean, really cool stuff. We came back in July. I retired from that from the FAA, and we decided we weren't going to deal with the tent this time because that's hard. So we bought a little RV and pulled it alongside. I took a trip down to the Redwoods. We went to Yosemite. We went to Sedona in Arizona, and we just had a great trip. And we headed east and got to West Virginia in July. And got here in time for our newest granddaughter to be born in the end of July. So that's what I do now. We're gonna take our grandkids on a train ride out of Romney, West Virginia today. Polar Express, Santa's gonna be on it. And we're available for these kids. That's the cool thing about this. My sponsor told me when I first came into AA, you come to meetings and you don't drink, go to meetings, and stay available for good things to happen, right? And I used to think that meant wait by the phone for somebody to call. What I understand now, though, being available for good things to happen means I don't drink. I am available for whatever the day has in store for me. I'm not hungover. I'm not angry all the time and just trying to push people away. I take people in, and I'm available for those kind of things that happen in my life. And that's because of sobriety, absolutely without a doubt. Everything in my life. I can owe to Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, the relationships with my family, and I talked about the thing with my mom, and I'll go back to that. I told her about that, and I never told anybody about taking that beer. Never. Never. I was terrified, and we sat down, and I talked to her about it, and she explained to me. She goes, "Your dad was going to drink, no matter what. That was just an excuse he was waiting for. It had nothing to do with you, and just totally forgave me, and I was able to get that out of my life and realize that if I was a drunk, that's exactly what I would have done too. I would have would look for some excuse to pick up a drink, and I was a drunk, and I knew that, So, but I could have that kind of real conversation with somebody in my family that I loved and it meant so much to me. I think that was the day I talked to my mom. I had a conversation with her and told her that if I could have had any mom in the world, I would have picked her. So that was the kind of real meaningful kind of stuff that we were able to talk about. I was the only one of the kids in my family that came into AA, and I had a relationship with my mom especially that they just didn't get. That was the bond that we had as mother and son were great because I was a mama's boy. But then the bond we had as both being active members of Alcoholics Anonymous, man, that was just sensational. And it was so cool to be able to go to meetings with her from different times than I did that. So coming around, I'll stop now. The The gratitude I have for the rooms of AA, I just can't put them into words other than to say, I just never imagined any of this stuff could happen to me. I was terrified most of the time. I was afraid, and I felt that I needed to drink to take that stuff away. And it really what it did is it made me more scared. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got anything I ever wanted to get out of booze, I've gotten here. I've gotten courage. I've gotten, friendship. I've gotten all, the anxiety's gone away mostly. Comes back. I know what to do now. But all that stuff is all attributed to coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and staying sober. Thanks.